Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a poetry reading presented by the Boston University Creative Writing Program in the College of Arts and Sciences. Our guest speakers are world-renowned poet C.K. Williams and Creative Writing Program alumna Eleanor Goodman. We begin with a greeting by former poet laureate Robert Pinsky.
Fred Levin and Nancy Livingston endowed through the Shenton Foundation. They endowed a reading series with a special character that fits the character of the BU MFA program. This is called the Robert Lowell Memorial Poetry Reading in the spirit of Room 222. Room 222 is across the street. It's where Sigrid Estrada and Leslie Epstein and Hodgin and Louise Glick and Dan Chazen and I still conduct the graduate writing seminars in that same room. And the spirit of that room refers to the fact that the poet Robert Lowell taught a seminar there in which the students included Sylvia Plath, Anne Sexton, and our colleague George Starbuck. So the spirit is one in which the fact that they were artists and writers together is more important than their academic rank. To recognize that, our tradition here, which is now, I think this may be the 16th one, the tradition is that a recent BU creative writing student introduces the guest. So you'll hear a BU alum read, give a very brief reading, and then introduce the guest. This is the first time C.K. Williams gave the first Robert Lowell lecture in 2003. He is the first one to be invited back to do it a second time. My role is to have explained all of that to you and to say a little bit about our recent alumna, Eleanor Goodman, who is going to give a brief reading and then introduce C.K. Williams. When Eleanor was here, BU had only begun becoming an unusually international or global creative writing program. We had a translation seminar, but Hodgin had not yet begun teaching his course in The Writer as Migrant. We did not yet have the global fellowships, which now send well over half of our creative writing students to various countries, mainly non-English speaking countries, in the spirit of approaching writing in an international way. Eleanor Goodman was ahead of that game. When she took the translation seminar, she worked in translations from Mandarin Chinese. I still remember the poem that she brought into class, what is it? 10 years ago or so, or 9 years ago. I still remember reading a poem about a man plucking a chicken on a street in Shanghai, and the poem was not about the exotic or the touristic. It was about the reality of that man and that chicken and his relatives and the chicken's relatives on that street among other streets in that real city. This is characteristic of Eleanor, who has another wonderful poem called Foreign Tongues. She's associated with the Fairbanks Institute at Harvard University in Far East Studies. Sometime in the next year or so, her translation will come out of the selected poems of, get this, Xi Zhang Ni Zi, of a Chinese poet. We're very proud of Eleanor, and she will now read her poems to you and then introduce our main reader, C.K. Williams. Eleanor Goodman.
It is such a thrill to be back at BU to read for all of you. And Robert, what a gorgeous introduction. Thank you so much. Okay, I'll try to speak into the microphone. I'm just going to read a few short poems tonight from a book that of my own poetry that I'm putting together, tentatively titled Habitation. So I'll just dive in. Ancestry. My father, whose first memory is flying from his mother's hands out the second-story window, caught by a neighbor below on the Niederstrasse, taught me to pick up pennies for luck. At 70, he still bends on bad knees for coins. Oma leapt after from that burning house to escape Berlin and the bomb fire, sprayed by the country they fled to, through slogs of hunger and the unwelcoming Alps. For years, she kept boiled eggs and a stub of sausage in the pocket of her rose-scented apron so the children wouldn't go hungry again. Four wars later, none of which I've seen, I winch out nickels wedged between bricks in Harvard Square, and the homeless men with wired bodies under layers of sweatshirts in August watch me in my silk scarf and heels. And once one asked me where the hell I'm coming from. I was lucky enough to spend some time in Rome last winter, which is a beautiful city. And slightly outside of the city center in Trastevere, there's this very unassuming little church which houses a Bernini sculpture. It's a marble sculpture of a nun who is dying and in an ecstasy of receiving God. Which I thought was slightly subversive. And this is a poem that came out of that. It's part of a longer work that I'm still writing about that time in Rome. So this is the third section, three. In the church of San Francesco a Ripa, Bernini's widowed nun clutches a hand to her breast, her face a marble gape with teeth exposed, neck cocked so the folds of her wimple frame her pleasure as she is entered, forgetting the flesh body at the moment she is most of it. But the only sin is to close the self to holiness, to turn away the angel that comes to the window hungry, and not to let an ecstasy of the soul, like art, like death, arch the back, ripple the skin below the stomach. Yes, Bernini felt it, yes. Her pillow is made of stone, but feels like silk. Changing emotional gears somewhat, I'd like to take you south across the continent into Africa and the horrific violence that has been going on there. I should say that the Limpopo River is... it forms the border between Zimbabwe and the relative safety of South Africa. To leave Zimbabwe, you must cross the gray corpse of the Limpopo River, balancing your life on your head, while crocodiles with dried mud eyes skulk the bank. When you crawl on your belly from the dank muck of the war, they come for you. Their teeth rip you open, and the wound will fester and swell into a burden carried on your back like wet kindling. As Robert so generously mentioned, a large part of my literary life is taken up with translation. I translate contemporary Chinese literature, primarily poetry, and I have been working on a selected work of the poet Wang Xiaoni. very close, Robert, very close. she's originally from the north of China, but she now lives in Shenzhen. And born in 1955, she is very much alive and kicking and still writing wonderful poetry. And I just want to read to you from the beginning of a long poem of hers that is from 2011. And the poem is called Fear, 害怕. One, it comes without warning all at once, tearing open cracks between images, breaking down the last sluice. Water collapses from the sky, flowing past the prettified kapok trees. From a mute's abandoned throat, a desert overflows. On both sides of the glass is a deep wasteland. The shoals have a peculiar shine, like large fish just stripped of their reeking skins. On the white fans, a few soft-boned creatures dance. Mankind will soon exit. The stage manager dies first. broken arms will pile up. On unreal days where nothing happens, people face devastation, danger fumbles past, testing its depth. After, the ocean will solidify into a salt plain. It will slip bit by bit back to its bitter salt nature. Unknowable creatures will rise anew from the ocean and secretly open layer by layer while we slip on the crystal's polished surface and cannot stand again. I just want to read very briefly from the Chinese to give you a sense of the musicality of the language and of the incredibly rich materials that I get to work with as a translator. I'll just read like the first stanza or two. So it's fear, 害怕. 一是没有先兆的，是一下子的偶然翻开一些影像的间隙，最终的闸门爆破了，垮掉的水被天空放出来，漫过梳妆打扮的木棉树，从那个哑人废掉的嗓子跑出四面漫开的大沙漠。 玻璃的前后其实正是还原深处，滩涂奇怪的亮，像大鱼刚剥开新鳍的皮，白色的上面上捂着几个软骨头的动物，人类即将退场，报幕者最先死去，断臂堆积成小山。 It's just an amazing language. thank you. I will transmit your applause to Wang Xiaoni, who deserves it. As Robert, well, I mean, I have immersed myself a lot in Chinese literature, and in my early 20s, I lived in Shanghai. And 8 years later, when I went back to Shanghai, I found that the little neighborhood, which I had completely fallen in love with, had been almost entirely razed, and a new cityscape was being put up in its place. So this very short poem, my last poem, comes from that. It's called Then Something. These narrowed streets I once called home are home to others now. Their words begin to fail me. I cannot bring a self to mind. In piles of bricks crushed by feet, a dog noses for trash. A beggar picks his way across the filthy puddles. Easy to cling to these desires, to covet their fruits like the parrot who strains in silence against his perch-chained claw. The sun savors its strength. A humid breeze teases the heat through peach trees, flinging blessings everywhere. Thank you all so much. It is now my very great honor to introduce C.K. Williams, a poet whose work speaks to human experience, both high and low, gritty and ephemeral. In his often lengthy, long-lined poems, readers discover a rare empathy and emotional nakedness that reveal the girders of experience as seen from the inside. From art to epileptics to a grandfather's death, to men laying down asphalt, his work evinces a strong but complex morality of the ordinary. And in that way, it presents us to ourselves in all our strength and failings. C.K. Williams has produced 19 books of poetry, 4 books of translation, several works of prose, and 2 children's books. He has won an astonishing list of awards, including a Guggenheim, a National Book Critics Circle Award, and a Pulitzer. He shows no signs of slowing down, and his newest book of poems has just come out this past fall and is called Writers Writing Dying. Please help me welcome C.K. Williams.
Hey, that's great. So I had a meeting with students this afternoon, a question and answer. They ask me questions, and I ask them questions. And I realize that's always a sort of dangerous thing to do before a reading. I was once at the University of Arizona, sitting with a friend of mine who was a painter and some drama students. And a play was being performed that had been written by the drama teacher, the drama composition teacher. And it was a terrible play. And at one particularly awful moment, one of the students said never to do that. So after talking with the students this afternoon, they're going to sit there and say, he said, don't do that, don't do that. So I spoke with them. I don't speak much between poems, but I'll mention. I spoke to them. The first question was, what's the most important thing you have to say to us? And I said, the most important thing really is that reading and writing aren't separate acts. The reading and writing of poetry aren't separate acts. So this poem is sort of a commentary on that. It's called Whacked. Every morning of my life, I sit at my desk getting whacked by some great poet or other. Some Yeats, some Auden, some Herbert or Larkin, and lately a whole tribe of others, oy, younger than me. Whack. Wiped out every day. I mean, since becoming a poet. I mean, wanting to. One never is really a poet, or I'm not, not when I'm trying to write. Though then comes a line, maybe another, but still pops up again, Yeats say, and again, whacked. Wait. Old brain in my head, I'd forgotten that whacked in crime movies means murdered, rubbed out by the mob. Little the mob guys would think that poets could do it, and who'd believe that instead of running away, you'd find yourself fleeing towards them, some sweet-seeming bishop who's saying so, 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 but whack, you're stampeding again through her poems like a Mustang, whack so hard that you break the old bash, the already broken crown of your head on the roof of your stall. What a relief for a while to read some bad poems. Still, I try not to. Bad, whackless poems can hurt you, can say you're all right when you're not, can condone your poet coward who compulsively asks if you're all right. Am I all right? Not wasting your time. Am I wasting time? Though you know you are wasting time if you're not being whacked. Bad poems let you off that. The confessional mode now. I've read reams. I've written as many. Meanwhile, this morning, this very morning, I'm thinking of George Herbert composing. I see him by himself in some candlelit chamber, unbearably lonely to me, to us, but glorious to him, and he's hunched over, scribbling, scribbling, and the room's filling with poems whacking at me, and Herbert's not even paying attention as the huge tide of them rises and engulfs me in warm tangles of musical down as from the breast of the choir dawn tangling larks, lovely enchanting language, sugar cane, whack, the sweet strains, the lullings, oh whack, Lowell or Keats, Rilke or Wordsworth or Wyatt, whack, 50 years of it, old racehorse, plug pulling its junk, isn't it time to be put out to pasture, but ah, I'd still if I could lie down like a mare giving birth, arm in my own uterine channel to tug out, one another, one more, only one more poor damp little poem, then I'll be happy. I promise, I swear. This is called 100 Bones, and it's older than almost everybody in this room, as I am older than, 3 times older than most people in this room, come to think of it. I never thought of it. That's awful. Isn't that depressing? I'm 3 times older than you are. Anyway, it happens during the Second War, so there's some references I should explain. I refer to Wildcats, Thunderbolts, or Corsairs. They were the fighter planes in the Second World War, and when we were kids, they were sort of your heroes, the fighter, but the Lightnings. Then there's a reference to the Liberator, which was a bomber. Then there's a reference to Basho, who was the great Japanese poet. And there's a little epigraph that I'll read from him. And there's a reference at the end of the poem to the frog, the disappearing frog. He wrote a famous haiku that nobody has ever figured out how to translate, which is basically the frog jumps from the log, plop. And he wrote a wonderful definition of a poet in which this is an excerpt. In this mortal frame of mine, which consists of 100 bones and 9 orifices, there is something, and this something can be called, for lack of a better word, a windswept spirit. 100 bones. And thus the 100 bones of my body, plus various apertures, plus that thing I don't know yet to call spirit, are all aquake with joyous awe at the shriek of the fighter planes that from their base at Port Newark swoop in their practice run so low over our building that the walls tremble. Wildcats, they're called, thunderbolts or corsairs, and they're practicing strafing, which in war means your machine guns are going like mad as you dive down on the enemy soldiers and other bad people, nips, krauts, trying to run out from your wings, your bullet pops leaping after their feet. It's a new word for us, strafing. We learn others, too. Blockbusters, for instance, which means blocks that bombs that smash down your whole block. Not our block, some nip block or Nazi, some gray block in the newsreel. B-24 is the number of my favorite bomber, the Liberator. My best fighter, Lightning. The other kind of lightning once crashed on an eave of our building, and my mother cried out and swept me up in her arms. The war is here, she must have thought. The war has found me. All her life, I think she was thinking, the war is here, the war has found me. Some words we don't know yet. Gas chamber, napalm, children our age in 1944 say my friend Arnold and I, who are discussing how we'll torture our treacherous enemy friends who've gone off to a ball game without us. They're like enemies, Japs or Nazis, so of course torture. Do children of all places and times speak so passionately and knowledgeably about torture? Our imaginations are small, though. Arnold's and mine, tear out their nails, burn their eyes, drive icicles in their ears so there's no evidence of your having done it except they're dead. Then it was Arnold who died. He was a doctor out west. He learned to fly Piper Cubs and flew out to help Navajo women have babies. He'd become a good man. Then he was dead. But right now, victory, V-Day, clouds like giant ice creams over the evil Japanese Empire. Cities are burning. Some Japanese cities aren't even there. The war is here. The war has found me. Japanese poets come later. We don't know we need them until they're red already buffing the lens. Basho, Issa, Busson, especially Basho. Ah, that windswept spirit. Ah, that hardly there frog. Atom bomb, though. Basho as shadow burned into asphalt, house torn by mad burning wind, poets in coats of straw burning. What is our flaw, we human beings? What is our error? Spikes in your tushy, ice in your brain, that frog invisibly waiting forever to make its leap. Somebody asked me at dinner if I still write political poems. The great Millicent Bell asked me. So this one is called Vile Jelly. There's some references in it to sculptors who are pre-Greek sculptures, Mesopotamian sculptures. There's a fairy tale. There's a reference to King Lear. The line in King Lear when Gloucester is having his eyes put out, and Edmund says, out, out, vile jelly. And the title of the poem is Vile Jelly. I see they're tidying the Texas textbooks again. chopping them down to make little minds stay the right size for the preachers not to be vexed as they troll for converts or congregants or whatever. Troll, as in fish for men, as in for Christ. Here's a fisher, a pre-biblical king on a slab. Captives, the king with a not-sharp spear is blinding the first, thrusting, then twisting it into the writhing man's eye. Subtle carvers they were. You can see the thrust and twist, how the hook, the fish hook, driven through the lip of the victim to keep him from inconveniently struggling and attached to a rope, tugs the lip out from the teeth. Because the whole state of Texas buys the same book, the import of their distortions and falsehoods is wide. The publishers take them into account, so other state school books are dumbed down as well. Who said, with my eyes closed, I see more? Not me. Who said, I study not to learn, but hoping what I've learned might not be true? Not me again. I stay still. I peek warily out the door of my stove. That's a story about seeing, not having to see. A fairy tale with your usual prince, this time in a stove. It doesn't say why he's there, even after he's saved by your usual virgin. The scholars don't explain either. My theory is he locked himself in, welded the lid because of all he could no longer bear to behold. Texas textbooks, for instance. Chunks of knowledge extracted like eyes, discarded, thrown on a floor. Evolution, needless to say. Sociology, Jefferson, deism. All these complications henceforth won't vex. They'll be scraped from the mold, no longer be seen. As much as no longer is seen in the world as well. Will the eyes of conscience also be punctured, spilled? Vile jelly, it's called in King Lear. Vile jelly, out. Chips of blank, Dickinson wrote in a war poem. Chips of blank in boyish eyes. Is that still in the books? Is the king on his slab with his spear and rope? But that was before Christ rose into his own stove. The noise of mankind, another god groused, is too loud, they keep me awake, rid me of them. The underling angels began boiling the acid, but thanks be, someone had learned how to write. An inscription appeared on a roof. Please, it pled to the prickly deity, don't. And the Almighty, yawning for once after a good nap, decided to let us do it unto ourselves, which we're rushing to do as quick as we can, by making the mysteries holy and blank, by chopping eyes from susceptible minds, susceptible hearts, thou vilest jelly. Herds of children go bleeding into the dark. O vile, thou chips of blank, thou boyish eyes. Here's a little change of tone. This is called Bianca Burning. Now, there's a reference in it to a writer that some of you might not know, but absolutely should. The writer is Bruno Schulz, who was a Polish prose writer, you wouldn't call him a novelist, who wrote in the 1930s mostly. He was also an artist who did very erotic etchings, which are mentioned in the book. And he was really one of the great prose writers of the 20th century, and I realize most students haven't heard of him, so go look him up. He's only got two books in English, but they're both works of great genius. And in one of the books, he's got a character named Bianca, and he's a child, just hitting puberty, and he's madly in love with Bianca, who basically doesn't even know he's there. But in his writing about her, so this poem is called Bianca Burning, and it refers and quotes from Bruno Schulz's work about Bianca Burning. The sexual terror lions are roaring into my ears as I make my way between their cages at the Bertram Mill Circus in England in 1947 when I'm 20. The terrible lions have roared for 6 months, and though I don't know it, they'll roar for six more, then be extinguished, leaving only their irksome echo the rest of my life. A circus. I'm traveling with a circus, an exotic thing to think, and I have a Bianca, not the Bianca Bruno Schulz had in his spring and, quote, enchanting Bianca, unquote, whom one, quote, would notice how with every step, light as a dancer, she enters her being, unquote. A Bianca, rather, who's lush, ardent, and though only 18, more amorously advanced than I am, with breasts too beautiful to remember, and that other thing further down she'll bring with her every day to my digs, to roll with me on my bed while I flail and despair, and return to with her back through that savage alley, that gauntlet of error and terror, to the caravan where her father and mother lived, and where we ate dinner together. Bianca's father is a clown, not the way I was a clown, not the way Schulz depicts himself in his drawings as almost a clown with his rack of compulsions. Bianca's father's a real clown, famous, with different names in different countries, who in the ring in his chaplain-esque costume is hilarious, reckless, contagiously joyful. Yet Bianca's father, like me, is possessed by a terror, though no one dares frame it that way. Bianca's mother, you see, has claustrophobia, a terrible case, and it was agreed that for her to sleep in their cramped trailer would be painful, insupportable, really. So Bianca's beautiful mother, lusher even than Bianca, and so young, seen from here, younger than my daughter now, would kiss her impassive, pipe-smoking husband and leave in the car that came every night to take her to the circus owner's yacht. And we remnants, we relics, would gloomily sit, Bianca, because soon she'd have to go back to her job as a nightclub dancer, and the husband, for obvious reasons, and me, part of the act now, with my rituals of desire and my dread of the lions I'll pass again as I wend the torturous route to my room to wait for Bianca's next visit tomorrow with her breasts and that other thing which I could hardly bring myself in those days to call by its name, so fearsome it was, as it was for the tragic and timid Schulz, who even in his erotic sketchings of perfectly formed nudes with Schulz-like men abjectly groveling, crushed, dejected under their elegant feet, depicts no vaginas, or none not submerged in inkiest shadow, save one, and that sketchy, inconsequential, which surely proves that Schulz knew the firmament of vagina is fathomless, without measurable dimensions, altering such shape as it does have with impatience, but for which Schulz's Bianca, who, quote, controlled her glamour with pity, unquote, and whose wisdom was, quote, full of sadness, unquote, must by now offer demure consolations, while mine, my Bianca, struts with top hat and whip across the arena to take her bow. I actually Googled old Bianca once. And there she was in a film clip from probably soon after I was with her, probably the early 1960s, late 1950s. And it was a clip of different singers singing the same song, different Italians. Her name was Italian. And her father was Danish, her mother was Swedish. They spoke every language in Europe. anyway, there's different singers singing the same song. Then the last one is a bunch of guys playing instruments and Bianca just standing there with her beautiful breasts. And that was clearly the point of the film clip, was her beautiful breasts. It's gone off the internet now, so I can't even tell you where to find it. So this is called Mask. There's a reference in it to Satayana, who was the great Harvard philosopher, Hölderlin, who was the great German poet who went insane and who will appear. Then there's Yeats, who had many identities as a poet. I mentioned Michael Robartes and Kekulé. And I think Agamemnon. We all know who Agamemnon is, right? Okay. Ready? With these poems, I sort of unconsciously, what happened was, I didn't realize it until it was afterwards, that when I started writing this book of poems, I realized that there's a convention in your poetry, that you're in poetry mostly, not in Pinsky's poems, but the convention is that you're sitting alone and you're thinking of things, and you're alone, cut off in one way or another from the rest of the world. And it's a great convention. But I realized that actually when I sit down to write, my mind is filled with other writers, as you know from the first poem. So I decided at some point, without quite deciding, that I would just put them all in. You know, they're there in my mind, so why not let them be in the poems? So that's why there are all these things I have to explain to the uninitiated. This is called Mask. Nobody had to tell me in the monster movie to hide my eyes and not look. It hurt to be frightened. You can't not look, though, later on in the movie of mind, that sex theater inside you, that thug. I'd think, inside I must be an evil person. Didn't I lust? Wouldn't I be if I could, that big-bellied thug? Or was it rather, I must be inside an evil person, these famished eyes, this insatiable staring out? No surprise I'd decide I needed a mask to live in, a disguise to conceal the monster I was certain I was. Not the Lone Rangers, I knew that cheap muslin from Halloween, I needed a real mask. No matter Santayana warning, a mask is not responsive, you must not speak to it or kiss it. No matter Hölderlin's doctor inventing a mask for his tormented patients so they couldn't scream. Didn't Yeats have his file of fake willies, his anti-self, his Kekulé, his Michael Robartes? Why couldn't I then? Why was I stranded like the insole of a shoe in this face glued on so tightly? Yet when I'd borrow masks, nothing ever quite fit, and they'd soon become shapeless and stink. Better the semblance, I thought, with no conscience or name that takes any impress, like free verse. But within that face was silence, then sound, too much of one, then too much of the other, grinding together like gears, they extruded a wobbly, always weirdly wrong word glop. Years pass. Love, no love. At last arrives Dr. Freud, who opens your face so you can look in. Desire, terror, and rage twined writhing together. An id consoles Freud. Call it your id. So there you are, the inside of your psyche, riven with scar, waiting to heal, knit, become true. But hadn't we already died waiting? Weren't we scattered like crumbs through the Pleistocene forest for Hansel and Gretel to gather and hand on to Marx, who proclaimed the face itself was the veil, beaten capitalist gold, cunning, entrancing, enchanting like the death mask of Agamemnon? Old age, then. Skull in the mirror with jowls and hair in its ears, arriving without your permission, that iron mask, this simulacrum, bland, boring, unsexy, locked to you like a chastity belt. how it barely cracks smiles, how it moons dolefully back at you like your dog, how it can't lie. Old rocky face, crumbling, eroding, unmasked, lonely ranger, and this time, no covering your eyes. This is called Exhaust. People who appear in it, Albert Camus, the great French philosopher, thinker, who wrote a book called The Myth of Sisyphus that was basically about suicide seeming the most normal, the most rationally moral thing one could do, but that probably it wasn't a good idea to do it. Then there's Anne Sexton, who studied across the street and who killed herself in a car with the exhaust, running the gas in from the exhaust. Then there's the painter Jackson Pollock, the writers Sebald, Nathaniel West, and I think you'll get it all. Exhaust. My grandson wants a Ferrari. I buy one for him. Why not? The second a Mercedes, the third a Porsche. Why not? How things change. My grandfather wanted only the pickup one icy Rochester night the year before I was born. He skidded through a gate in and plowed head on into a train. My grandson's cars cost a dollar, part of a vast collection of racers, convertibles, trucks, even antiques from the time I had my first car, a five-year-old ungainly green Chevy, not like Lowell's father's spanking new one with gilded hoofs, wrote Lowell, and slashingly his best friend. I treasured my Chevy, too, though it plodded compared with a friend's olds that sped us one New Year's Eve after the parties down the parkway at 110. My grandfather, I gather, was vain of his truck and his driving, but my grandmother would grumble he was a terrible driver. We were good drivers, we were certain, better than good. Didn't we all but live in our cars? Wasn't the best part even of a date when you made out with your girlfriend in back? Right now, hitting 100, don't we love each other for how our tires are glued to the pavement and life has no end? I hadn't seen yet Warhol's print of mangled teenagers spilled from their wreck. I didn't see much then beyond cars, like my grandsons who know every make, model, top speed, and 0 to 60 by heart, and who'll squabble because one has stolen another's X something or other. My grandfather was a socialist when that word still could be used. He even ran for state senate, though not surprisingly lost. He was hardly well off with a store that sold candy and papers, and why he needed that broken-down truck my grandmother still complained on her deathbed was a mystery to her. The first time I was almost killed in a car, an axle sheared, our back wheel bounced past us, we spun out of control over a busy highway and pulled up a yard from a tree, much like the tree in the photo of the death of Camus with his publisher's sports car gruesomely wrapped around it. Such a short time between my automobile madness and my rapture reading Camus, Sisyphus telling me why suicide wasn't the route, though at the time it could seem so. What did he say exactly? I don't think there was much about love, which would be my reason now. Love, family, poetry, art. I sometimes imagined my Chevy was devoted to me like a dog. That was before death arrived, mine and everyone else's. Anne Sexton's father died in a car. Dear Anne made certain to too. Pollock, Sebald, Nathaniel West, Tom Mix, for God's sakes. Me nearly four times, and my grandfather, Charles Kasdan, whom I just realized now I miss. And whom, if I'd been there, I know I could have saved. pump the brakes gently, I tell him, and we'd glide up to the rails and wait in the beautiful snow. He'd offer some wisdom to hand on to my grandsons, the train clattering by us, the mingling steam of our breath. Haste. Not so fast, people were always telling me. Slow down. Take your time. Teachers, coaches, the guy who taught me to ride. Stop cowboying, he'd shout, as if that wasn't the point. But the admonition that stuck was the whisper, that girl, that woman, that smudged now, dear girl, woman, legs so tightly wound round me, sighed, young as she was, to my ear. Ah, the celestial contraption we made, though. No matter how you swerved it, it held together. Why not go faster? But she, with her fluttery guttural, slower, go slower, knew better, knew better. No one says, not so fast now. Not Catherine when I hold her, not our dog as I putter behind her. Yet everything, past, present, future, rushes so quickly through me, I frayed like a flag. Unbuckle your spurs, life. Don't you know up ahead where the road ends, there's an abyss? No room for galloping anymore here. Surely by now you should know better, know better. At dinner, we were speaking of the Yiddish poets. Most people don't know that there were a group of really great Yiddish poets who lived in New York in the first part of the 20th century. And we were speaking about it. I had been reading at an Irish poetry festival, and it had occurred to me that the Irish had had their language taken away from them in the 19th century. It was sort of basically destroyed by the occupying English. So when the Irish came to America, they just lived in English. And Yiddish, which was the language of the Jews, mostly in Eastern Europe and somewhat in Spain, when they came, were faced with the problem of which language to write in. And they were mostly, as someone pointed out at dinner, they mostly had four or five languages, so they had to choose. And the Yiddish culture in New York was a very lively culture, and they decided to write in Yiddish. And it's an unfortunate decision because the culture, when Israel was founded, Yiddish was basically wiped out by Hebrew. Anyway, that's just a little historical footnote, and also because there's a poet in this poem named, I call him Yash Glotstein. His name was Jacob Glotstein in English. He calls himself Yash, and that's why I called him. And so I wanted you to know about him. This is called Poem for Myself for My Birthday. It's coming at me again, damn, like that elephant with its schoonering ears charging in Uganda. We were okay, we thought, in our rover, so it was a nice mix of scary and thrilling, plus a story to tell. That behemoth, wow, snorting a few yards off in the bush, waving his huge, crushing tusks, then rushing out at us, like my birthday. Like thinking of birthdays, this one, the next to last, and, ouch, the last, all stampeding towards me like that most likely ill outlaw, ponderous looking but fast on his feet, you can't even dream of dancing out of the way. Out of the way, step on the gas, okay, we're out of there, safe, wait though. I'm not safe. This time my birthday's a tractor trailer skidding sideways on ice, and I'm noodling by on my bike, my darling old Rally, and the whole frame's pretzeled around me. Happy birthday. Oh, please. My last happy was that first one with a party, gooey brown cake and four beautiful candles, and they're singing to me. Even now it seems worth having lost one of my not enough years. I love being sung to, and how not love that song, especially to you, to be you in a song. Now I'm often you to myself, you selfish, you indolent slug. When did that happen? I see the Dalai Lama's birthday's here too. In his photo, he pumps a treadmill like a prayer wheel and proclaims, boasts, admits, I visualize my death every day. I wonder if he's you to himself. Speaking of visualization, Yash Gladstein has a poem for my 200th birthday where he talks of words with friends in the garden, then makes love to his, quote, soft, obedient maid, unquote. Very sweet. Nostalgia for the future. Ingenious device when your present's all but used up. But forget the Meshuggah future. I can't even get the past straight. Everything keeps popping up changed. It's like being, not being in, being one of those movies that starts with a flash forward, then poof, the plot's rushed ahead and you're still back where you began and way out here near the end. Did Glotstein's wife ever forgive him, that succulent poem made? Catherine would go crazy. No problem for the celibate Dalai Lama, though I'd bet there have been enough maids he could have, well, slept with, the way Gandhi slept with young girls when he was old, to keep warm, he avowed, as did King David. All those thank you notes to be written, those apology calls, you liar, you cheat. Happy birthday to me, Dalai Lama and me, bound now that poor stricken elephant's probably dead. To him, too, happy returns, and me spinning by on my bike singing to you, oh, to you. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a poetry reading presented by the Boston University Creative Writing Program in the College of Arts and Sciences, featuring C.K. Williams and Eleanor Goodman. We began with an introduction by former poet laureate Robert Pinsky. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, WBUR.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.